Tonight at the Royal Albert Hall, we'll be hearing one of the best-known concertos in the orchestral repertoire, Mozart's Clarinet Concerto. Together with a piece receiving only its second Proms performance, the tone poem Eventyr, or Once Upon a Time by Frederick Delius, based on a collection of Norwegian folk tales. With Beethoven's Egmont Overture to begin and Carl Nielsen's Fifth Symphony to end, it's going to be an evening of vivid colours and contrasts from the BBC Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Osmo Vanska, and with Michael Collins joining the lineup to play basset clarinet in the Mozart. More of that later. Beethoven is first, with music written for a Goethe play of 1788 that tackled weighty themes of oppression and injustice. The Flemish Count Egmont refuses to submit to despotic Spanish rule. He won't compromise his principles of liberty and freedom of expression, and for that he dies a martyr. Well, Beethoven was famously a man of strong opinions himself, not to mention a great admirer of Goethe's writings. And he shared many of the views expressed by Egmont. So in 1809, when he was asked to supply the incidental music for a restaging of the play at Vienna's Burgtheater, he accepted gladly. He eventually went on to produce 9 separate pieces of music to accompany the action at various points, a mixture of vocal and orchestral pieces. The most famous of them, and the most enduring, was the powerful overture that we're about to hear from the BBC Symphony Orchestra. And the players are just putting the finishing touches to their tuning here on the platform. And I must say, an enormous audience tonight here at the Royal Albert Hall. People have come out in force to hear tonight's programme. I suspect Michael Collins and the Mozart being a particular draw. And applause now for the guest leader of the BBC Symphony Orchestra, Helena Wood. And here comes Osmo Vanska. Members of the orchestra rise as he makes his way to the podium to begin tonight's prom with Beethoven's overture, Egmont. There's a lot of power and urgency contained in that piece, short though it may be. The overture to Goethe's play Egmont, written by Beethoven as part of a suite of incidental music, and played tonight by the BBC Symphony Orchestra conducted by Osmo Vanska, making his way back on stage now. And quite typically for Beethoven, he became so wrapped up in the whole process of writing the piece that he missed the first night of the production, and it opened in Vienna in May 1810 without his music. But the music was added eventually in the middle of June. Well, next in tonight's prom, we'll hear another work with a Viennese connection. The clarinet concerto Mozart wrote for his friend Anton Stadler, who together with his brother Johann was a leading member of the Imperial Court Orchestra in Vienna. Now, Stadler's singing tone was very much admired, and he achieved it playing an instrument with a lower register than the present-day clarinet, not to mention a rather different appearance. And that earlier version of the instrument is what tonight's soloist, Michael Collins, will be playing too.
Mozart composed the concerto for the basset clarinet, and my teacher, Thea King, persuaded me to really learn and study the piece. She said, you know, you're the next generation of young clarinetists, and it's up to you to prove to the world that the concerto should be played on a basset clarinet. It's slightly darker because, of course, the longer the tube, the darker the sound. So we've got an extra four semitones, and those extra notes really transforms the whole character of the instrument. I mean, it still has the brightness at the top of the instrument, but, you know, so often I'm playing with the cellos and the bassoons in this low register, and some of the creaminess of this basset clarinet. It's just a joy to play, but also it's a minefield to play.
Tonight's soloist, Michael Collins. Well, Mozart made quite sure that his music was expertly tailored to show off Stadler's melting expressiveness. And that's something we'll hear, especially in the second movement, Adagio, something that Osmo Vanska was at great pains to bring out in this afternoon's rehearsal, sending us all into a bit of a reverie, actually, possibly including members of the orchestra too. But to give plenty of contrast, Mozart steps up the pace in the famously chirpy finale. Osmo Vanska, I might point out, is himself a clarinetist, so this is a piece that he feels a great affinity with. He actually began his musical career as a player. He was principal clarinet of the Helsinki Philharmonic before starting to study conducting. So here he is coming on stage now with Michael Collins, bearing that basset clarinet for tonight's prom's performance of Mozart's Clarinet Concerto.
Thank you. Thank you.
A roar of applause for Michael Collins and the BBC Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Osmo Vanska in the Clarinet Concerto by Mozart. Poignantly, the last orchestral work he completed before his death. Written for the Bassett Clarinet of his great friend Anton Stadler and played tonight by Michael Collins on that precursor to the modern instrument. He mentioned earlier its darker tones and the fact that they're achieved thanks to the extra length of the instrument, which is probably about double that of a modern clarinet, so it does look quite different. The one Michael Collins played doesn't look quite like the one Stadler had made for him, though. There's a picture of a copy of that one in tonight's programme book, and to our eyes it is distinctly odd, with an angled section at the end topped by a sort of enclosed bell. But Stadler and his brother Johann also played the Bassett horn, and the Bassett clarinet was created as an extra addition to their repertoire. Well, Michael Collins, of course, a great chamber musician, and as a soloist, very much in demand. He's commissioned many new works and had others dedicated to him. John Adams, Elliot Carter and Mark Anthony Turnage, just a few of the composers whose works he's premiered. And now, in parallel to his performing career, he's developing his career as a conductor. In fact, he's currently principal conductor of the City of London Sinfonia. And here he is, back on stage, having swapped his Bassett clarinet for a modern instrument.
Ladies and gentlemen, I hope you can hear me. Yes, I've picked up another instrument for the encore, and I've left the barrel in the dressing room. So Osmo's gone to get it for me. In which case, we shall play The Romance by Gerald Finzi from his Five Bagatelles. Thank you.
A nifty bit of teamwork from Michael Collins and Osmo Vanska, enabling us to hear that lovely romance, one of Gerald Finzi's bagatelles for clarinet and strings, which was recently recorded for CD by the BBC Symphony Orchestra, with Michael Collins playing and directing all five pieces. And if you'd like to hear more, you can. Malcolm Arnold's second concerto from that CD was in Afternoon on 3 today. You can listen again to that. And Stanford's clarinet concerto will be in the programme on Friday. That's from 2 o'clock. And Michael Collins back on stage, taking his solo bow, applauded by all of the orchestra and Osmo Vanska. As I said earlier, himself a one-time professional clarinetist, still a keen player actually. He performs chamber music with members of his Minnesota orchestra, including the Mozart Quintet. Well, that work by Finzi points forwards to more English music in the second half of tonight's prom, though with a Scandinavian inspiration. The orchestra turns to a Delius tone poem based on Norwegian folk tales. Then we'll hear the Fifth Symphony of the Danish composer Carl Nielsen. Now though, tonight's 20 minutes. Kew Gardens by Virginia Woolf. In this atmospheric piece set in the world-famous Botanic Gardens, humanity and nature come together on a gloriously hot summer's day. The reader is Lindsay Duncan.
From the oval-shaped flower bed there rose perhaps 100 stalks, spreading into heart-shaped or tongue-shaped leaves halfway up, and unfurling at the tip red or blue or yellow petals marked with spots of colour raised upon the surface. And from the red, blue or yellow gloom of the throat emerged a straight bar, rough with gold dust and slightly clubbed at the end. The petals were voluminous enough to be stirred by the summer breeze, and when they moved, the red, blue and yellow lights passed one over the other, staining an inch of the brown earth beneath with a spot of the most intricate colour. The light fell either upon the smooth grey back of a pebble or the shell of a snail with its brown circular veins, or, falling into a raindrop, it expanded with such intensity of red, blue and yellow the thin walls of water that one expected them to burst and disappear. Instead, the drop was left in a second, silver grey once more, and the light now settled upon the flesh of a leaf, revealing the branching thread of fibre beneath the surface. And again it moved on and spread its illumination in the vast green spaces beneath the dome of the heart-shaped and tongue-shaped leaves. Then the breeze stirred rather more briskly overhead, and the colour was flashed into the air above, into the eyes of the men and women who walk in Kew Gardens in July. The figures of these men and women straggled past the flowerbed with a curiously irregular movement, not unlike that of the white and blue butterflies who crossed the turf in zigzag flights from bed to bed. The man was about 6 inches in front of the woman, strolling carelessly, while she bore on with greater purpose, only turning her head now and then to see that the children were not too far behind. The man kept his distance in front of the woman purposely, though perhaps unconsciously, for he wished to go on with his thoughts. 15 years ago I came here with Lily, he thought. We sat somewhere over there by a lake, and I begged her to marry me all through the hot afternoon. How the dragonfly kept circling round us. How clearly I see the dragonfly and her shoe with a square silver buckle at the toe. All the time I spoke, I saw her shoe, and when it moved impatiently, I knew without looking up what she was going to say. The whole of her seemed to be in her shoe. All my love, my desire, were in the dragonfly. For some reason, I thought that if it settled there on that leaf, the broad one with the red flower in the middle of it, if the dragonfly settled on the leaf, she would say yes at once. But the dragonfly went round and round. It never settled anywhere, of course not, happily not. Or I shouldn't be walking here with Eleanor and the children. Tell me, Eleanor, do you ever think of the past? Why do you ask, Simon? Because I've been thinking of the past. I've been thinking of Lily, the woman I might have married. Well, why are you silent? Do you mind my thinking of the past? Why should I mind, Simon? Doesn't one always think of the past in a garden with men and women lying under the trees? Aren't they once past, all that remains of it? Those men and women, those ghosts lying under the trees? One's happiness, one's reality. For me, the square silver shoe buckle and a dragonfly. For me, a kiss. Imagine six little girls sitting before their easels 20 years ago, down by the side of a lake, painting the water lilies. The first red water lilies I'd ever seen. And suddenly, a kiss there on the back of my neck. And my hand shook all the afternoon so that I couldn't paint. I took out my watch and marked the hour when I would allow myself to think of the kiss for 5 minutes only. It was so precious. The kiss of an old, grey-haired woman with a wart on her nose. The mother of all my kisses, all my life. Come, Caroline, come, Hubert. They walked on past the flower bed, now walking four abreast, and soon diminished in size among the trees and looked half transparent as the sunlight and shade swam over their backs in large, trembling, irregular patches. In the oval flower bed, the snail, whose shell had been stained red, blue and yellow for the space of 2 minutes or so, now appeared to be moving very slightly in its shell, and next began to labour over the crumbs of loose earth, which broke away and rolled down as it passed over them. It appeared to have a definite goal in front of it, differing in this respect from the singular, high-stepping, angular, green insect who attempted to cross in front of it and waited for a second with its antennae trembling as if in deliberation, and then stepped off as rapidly and strangely in the opposite direction. Brown cliffs with deep green lakes in the hollows, flat, blade-like trees that waved from root to tip, round boulders of grey stone, vast crumpled surfaces of a thin, crackling texture. All these objects lay across the snail's progress between one stalk and another, to his goal. Before he had decided whether to circumvent the arched tent of a dead leaf or to breast it, there came past the bed the feet of other human beings. This time, they were both men. The younger of the two wore an expression of perhaps unnatural calm. He raised his eyes and fixed them very steadily in front of him while his companion spoke. And directly his companion had done speaking, he looked on the ground again and sometimes opened his lips only after a long pause and sometimes did not open them at all. The elder man had a curiously uneven and shaky method of walking, jerking his hand forward and throwing up his head abruptly, rather in the manner of an impatient carriage horse tired of waiting outside a house. But in the man, these gestures were irresolute and pointless. He talked almost incessantly. He smiled to himself and again began to talk, as if the smile had been an answer. He was talking about spirits, the spirits of the dead, who, according to him, were even now telling him all sorts of odd things about their experiences in heaven. Heaven was known to the ancients as Thessaly, William, and now, with this war, the spirit matter is rolling between the hills like thunder. He paused, seemed to listen, smiled, jerked his head and continued. You have a small electric battery and a piece of rubber to insulate the wire. Insulate? Well, we'll skip the details. No good going into details that wouldn't be understood. And in short, the little machine stands in any convenient position by the head of the bed, we will say, on a neat mahogany stand. All arrangements being properly fixed by workmen under my direction, the widow applies her ear and summons the spirit by sign as agreed. Women! Widows! Women in black! Here he seemed to have caught sight of a woman's dress in the distance, which in the shade looked a purple-black. He took off his hat, placed his hand upon his heart, and hurried towards her, muttering and gesticulating feverishly. But William caught him by the sleeve and touched a flower with the tip of his walking stick in order to divert the old man's attention. After looking at it for a moment in some confusion, the old man bent his ear to it and seemed to answer a voice speaking from it, for he began talking about the forests of Uruguay, which he had visited hundreds of years ago, in company with the most beautiful young woman in Europe. He could be heard murmuring about forests of Uruguay blanketed with wax petals of tropical roses, nightingales, sea beaches, mermaids, and women drowned at sea, as he suffered himself to be moved on by William, upon whose face the look of stoical patience grew slowly deeper and deeper. Following his steps so closely as to be slightly puzzled by his gestures, came two elderly women of the lower middle class, one stout and ponderous, the other rosy-cheeked and nimble. Like most people of their station, they were frankly fascinated by any signs of eccentricity betokening a disordered brain, especially in the well-to-do. But they were too far off to be certain whether the gestures were merely eccentric or genuinely mad. After they had scrutinised the old man's back in silence for a moment and given each other a queer, sly look, they went on energetically piecing together their very complicated dialogue. Nelbert Lot says Phil Pa, he says, I says, she says, I says, I says, I says. My Bert, says Bill Grandad, the old man, sugar. Sugar flakippers greens. Sugar, sugar, sugar. The ponderous woman looked through the pattern of falling words at the flowers standing cool, firm and upright in the earth with a curious expression. She saw them as a sleeper waking from a heavy sleep sees a brass candlestick reflecting the light in an unfamiliar way and closes his eyes and opens them and, seeing the brass candlestick again, finally starts broad awake and stares at the candlestick with all his powers. So the heavy woman came to a standstill opposite the oval-shaped flowerbed and ceased even to pretend to listen to what the other woman was saying. She stood there, letting the words fall over her, swaying the top part of her body slowly backwards and forwards, looking at the flowers. Then she suggested that they should find a seat and have their tea. The snail had now considered every possible method of reaching his goal without going round the dead leaf or climbing over it. Let alone the effort needed for climbing a leaf, he was doubtful whether the thin texture, which vibrated with such an alarming crackle when touched even by the tip of his horns, would bear his weight. And this determined him finally to creep beneath it, for there was a point where the leaf curved high enough from the ground to admit him. He had just inserted his head in the opening and was taking stock of the high brown roof and was getting used to the cool brown light when two other people came past outside on the turf. This time they were both young, a young man and a young woman. They were both in the prime of youth, or even in that season which precedes the prime of youth, the season before the smooth pink folds of the flower have burst their gummy case, when the wings of the butterfly, though fully grown, are motionless in the sun. Lucky it isn't Friday, he observed. Why? Do you believe in luck? They make you pay sixpence on Friday. What's sixpence anyway? Isn't it worth sixpence? What's it? What do you mean by it? Oh, anything. I mean, you know what I mean. The couple stood still on the edge of the flower bed and together pressed the end of her parasol deep down into the soft earth. The action, and the fact that his hand rested on the top of hers, expressed their feelings in a strange way, as these short, insignificant words also expressed something, words with short wings for their heavy body of meaning, inadequate to carry them far, and thus alighting awkwardly upon the very common objects that surrounded them, and were to their inexperienced touch so massive. But who knows? So they thought as they pressed the parasol into the earth. What precipices aren't concealed in them, or what slopes of ice don't shine in the sun on the other side? Who knows? Who has ever seen this before? Even when she wondered what sort of tea they gave you at Kew, he felt that something loomed up behind her words and stood vast and solid behind them. And the mist very slowly rose and uncovered. Heavens, what were those shapes? Little white tables and waitresses who looked first at her and then at him. And there was a bill that he would pay with a real 2-shilling piece, and it was real, all real, he assured himself, fingering the coin in his pocket, real to everyone except to him and to her. Even to him it began to seem real, and then, but it was too exciting to stand and think any longer, and he pulled the parasol out of the earth with a jerk and was impatient to find the place where one had tea with other people, like other people. Come along, Trissy, it's time we had our tea. Wherever does one have one's tea? She asked, looking vaguely round and letting herself be drawn on down the grass path, trailing her parasol, turning her head this way and that way, forgetting her tea, wishing to go down there and then down there, remembering orchids and cranes among wild flowers, a Chinese pagoda and a crimson-crested bird. But he bore her on. Thus one couple after another, with much the same irregular and aimless movement, passed the flower bed and were enveloped in layer after layer of green-blue vapour, in which at first their bodies had substance and a dash of colour, but later both substance and colour dissolved in the green-blue atmosphere. How hot it was! So hot that even the thrush chose to hop like a mechanical bird in the shadow of the flowers, with long pauses between one movement and the next. Instead of rambling vaguely, the white butterflies danced one above another, making with their white shifting flakes the outline of a shattered marble column above the tallest flowers. The glass roofs of the palm house shone as if a whole market full of shiny green umbrellas had opened in the sun. And in the drone of the aeroplane, the voice of the summer sky murmured its fierce soul. Yellow and black, pink and snow white, shapes of all these colours, men, women and children, were spotted for a second upon the horizon, and then, seeing the breadth of yellow that lay upon the grass, they wavered and sought shade beneath the trees, dissolving like drops of water in the yellow and green atmosphere, staining it faintly with red and blue. It seemed as if all gross and heavy bodies had sunk down in the heat motionless and lay huddled upon the ground, but their voices went wavering from them as if they were flames lolling from the thick waxen bodies of candles. Voices. Yes, voices. Wordless voices breaking the silence suddenly with such depth of contentment, such passion of desire, or in the voices of children, such freshness of surprise. Breaking the silence. But there was no silence. All the time, the motor omnibuses were turning their wheels and changing their gear, like a vast nest of Chinese boxes, all of wrought steel turning ceaselessly one within another, the city murmured, on the top of which the voices cried aloud and the petals of myriads of flowers flashed their colours into the air.
It was produced by Justine Willett. Well, welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall for the second part of tonight's BBC Prom, live on BBC Radio 3 and online in high-definition sound. And you can also join us on Twitter at BBC Proms. This is Penny Gore, and we're about to rejoin the BBC Symphony Orchestra and conductor Osmo Vanska for two more works. Carl Nielsen's Fifth Symphony, and before that, a rarely heard tone poem by Frederick Delius. Now, throughout this prom season, we've been marking the 150th anniversary of the birth of Delius and of his contemporary Claude Debussy. Now, Delius had quite a struggle in embarking on a musical career at all. His father wanted him to go into the family business, but he eventually gave his wholehearted blessing, partly after some energetic persuasion from Edvard Grieg, who'd met the young Delius in Leipzig and become something of a mentor. Delius not only venerated Grieg, he was also enthralled to the literature and landscape of Scandinavia. He was to draw on Danish texts in several works, including his opera Fenimore and Gerda. But it was a collection of 19th century Norwegian folk tales by Peter Christen Asbjørnsen that gave him the inspiration for Eventyr, Once Upon a Time, and the title can also be translated as Tales of Adventure. Delius started work on it during the First World War, when he was living temporarily in England, staying at the home of Sir Henry Wood. And it was finished back in France at Gré-sur-Loing in 1917, with a grateful dedication to Sir Henry. Well, Delius described this piece not as a tone poem, but as a ballad, and it's certainly full of vivid touches. I suppose you could say that it evokes the spirit of the Norwegian folk tales rather than particular characters or stories. Well, Delius's amanuensis Eric Fenby had quite a good description of it, as well as the warm-hearted, superstitious country folk. He said, "We also glimpse the weird interventions in their lives by the frightening creatures of legend, the trolls, giants, demons, and pixies." In fact, we'll hear a couple of interventions from some of those otherworldly beings. although slightly mysterious ones, rather strange climaxes when you'll hear shouts from an offstage male voice chorus, pre-recorded for tonight's performance. Not sure who they might be, trolls perhaps. Delius never quite let on. But here to conduct this performance of Aventure by Delius is Osmo Vanska, rejoining the BBC Symphony Orchestra.
Thank you. Thank you.
The BBC Symphony Orchestra, and a couple of brief pre-recorded interpolations from the men of the BBC Symphony Chorus, giving only the second Brahms performance of Aventure by Frederick Delius, Once Upon a Time, conducted by Osmo Vanska. Music redolent of the strange creatures of Scandinavian myth and inspired by a collection of Norwegian folk tales. Well, after those tales, tonight's prom ends with a symphony by Denmark's greatest composer, Carl Nielsen. He started to write his fifth symphony in 1921 in a mood of deep pessimism, not just in reaction to the breakdown of his marriage, but at the way the whole world seemed to be going in the aftermath of World War I. Here's Osmo Vanska.
I think that we are hearing some emotional part of one individual who has been scared or has heard news about war. And I think that there are some really dark moments in the symphony when it's obvious that he builds more and more tension, and then it's like one is screaming finally because there is no way to say any words, and you hope that there is some better time coming soon.
Osmo Vanska. Well, Nielsen said that the work's theme was the division of dark and light, the battle between evil and good. A battle fought out over the course of just two inventively structured movements. The first including an astonishing, almost frenzied outburst from a side drum. A note on the score instructs the percussionist to run amok, as if at all costs to stop the progress of the music. The second movement's hardly free of conflict either, but little by little a sense of regeneration takes hold. Horns and trumpets proclaim faith in life, and at last, in a blaze of new and resolute optimism, the symphony comes to an end. And it's a very different work from the piece that preceded it, Nielsen's fourth symphony, The Inextinguishable. It had been written actually during the First World War, and that had been a passionate affirmation of life and renewal in defiance of conflict. But those depressed years after the war had certainly taken their toll on Nielsen. And coming onto the platform now is Osmo Vanska to conduct the BBC Symphony Orchestra in Nielsen's Fifth Symphony.
Thank you. Thank you.
A final burst of almost manic, defiant energy to end Carl Nielsen's Fifth Symphony. The work that was, he said, the hardest thing he'd ever tried to do. Performed here at the BBC Proms by the BBC Symphony Orchestra under the baton of Osmo Vanska, who's making his way back on stage here. And those cheers are for him, although he's going round the orchestra now, picking out some of those players who made such a massive contribution. All of them did, of course, but we have those cheers for the principal clarinet, Richard Hosford. Sterling work from Alex Neal playing that extraordinary side drum solo. Bass trombone and tuba, Dan West and Sam Elliott. And all the members of the BBC Symphony Orchestra standing now. Osmo Vanska, one of several Finns conducting in the Proms this season, all of them studying with the same teacher. We've heard Jukka-Pekka Saraste, Susanna Malki and Sakari Oromo. And Osmo Vanska has a particular love of the works of Carl Nielsen. He's conducted the 2nd, 4th and 6th symphonies here at the Proms. And, well, just listen to that. That's a real Proms welcome. Osmo Vanska back on stage. The horns standing now, led by Principal Martin Owen. The trombones and trumpets, the whole of the brass section, in fact. And once again, the woodwind. And timpanist John Chimes underpinning the inexorable sense of militaristic might in that piece. That cheer is for him. And he brought that piece to its apparently optimistic conclusion. Well, the BBC Symphony Orchestra will be back here on Saturday at 7:30 with Oliver Nussen conducting his own 3rd symphony, plus pieces by Alexander Gurr and a new piece by Helen Grime, a BBC commission, as well as Debussy's complete incidental music for the Martyrdom of St. Sebastian. Well, that's all looking ahead to the weekend, but for the rest of this Monday night on Radio 3, time for me to hand you back now to Broadcasting House and Ian Skelly.
Penny, thank you very much. That was Penny Gore at the Royal Albert Hall for us tonight. And if you tuned in towards the end of that prom and you'd like to hear the whole of it again, the Nielsen, or for that matter the Beethoven, which was just as particularly exhilarating at the start of the concert, and the Mozart Clarinet Concerto played by Michael Collins, then you can listen to it all again either on the Radio 3 website for the next 7 days, or you can tune into Radio 3 on Sunday the 2nd of September when it'll form our Proms repeat programme that day in our Sunday concert slot. That's from 2 o'clock that afternoon. Tomorrow afternoon, incidentally, you can hear the prom which was given by the BBC Philharmonic when they celebrated Nordic composers. Stephen Osborne joined the orchestra to play Grieg's Piano Concerto. There was also music by Per Norgard, the first performance of his 7th symphony in the UK, and 2 symphonies, no less, by Sibelius, the number 6, and to end, the number 3. That's all tomorrow afternoon here on Radio 3 from 2. Well, next tonight at 10, Norman Lebrecht interviews another artist to appear at this year's Proms, the man who has shot to fame since he became the music director of the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra, Andrus Nelsons, with whom he'll be performing tomorrow night at the BBC Proms. They're going to be performing music by Glinka, a new piece given its UK premiere by Emily Howard, and to end that long and intense march to release the Leningrad Symphony, Shostakovich's 7th symphony. All live here on BBC Radio 3 from 7:30 tomorrow night. But tonight, as I say, you can hear the man with the baton in his hand, Andrus Nelsons, talking about his life and his career to date and what drove his love of music, which began, as you will no doubt hear, with Wagner at the tender age of 5. He talks to Norman Lebrecht tonight at 10. Well, to take us there, I thought we could hear some Shostakovich now. Music for smaller forces than full orchestra. This is a very passionate and deeply felt set of preludes by Shostakovich, composed originally for piano. He composed 24 of them, in fact, in 1932 when he was just 26 years old. And I'd say you can really hear the influence here of the many years he'd spent by then producing plenty of film music, particularly in this selection of 7 of the preludes, which were translated transcribed subsequently by Yevgeny Shtakov for viola and piano, and brought brilliantly to life here in this recording in the playing of Lawrence Powers. Simon Crawford Phillips is the pianist.
Thank you.
Seven of the preludes from the 24 by Shostakovich, originally for piano, in that sensitive transcription for viola and piano by Yevgeny Strakhov. Lawrence Power played the viola, Simon Crawford Phillips the piano. And that brings the time to nearly 9:55. At 10, the conductor who is masterminding tomorrow night's prom, Andras Nelsons, will be in conversation with Norman Lebrecht. Now, as I mentioned, you can hear Grieg's Piano Concerto in our proms programme tomorrow afternoon on Radio 3. Stephen Osborne, the soloist in that recent proms performance with the BBC Philharmonic. That's at 2:00 tomorrow afternoon. Well, to take us to 10:00 tonight, here's some Grieg now, and in the hands of another BBC orchestra, this time the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra, and conducted by a long-time associate of them, Jerzy Maksymiuk. This is Orza's Death. Grieg's depiction of the death of Peer Gynt's mother, Åsa. Music from the first of his suites from Peer Gynt, played by the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Jerzy Maksymiuk. And still time to hear their proms appearance from last week, including their highly acclaimed performance of not one, not two, but three symphonies by Vaughan Williams, conducted to a packed house by Andrew Manzi. It's all there for a couple more days on the BBC Radio 3 website.
Original British drama on BBC Two. A tale of love and repression in Edwardian England.
I know what it is that makes a man want to go away with a woman he likes, but that desire must be resisted.
Adapted for television by Tom Stoppard and starring Benedict Cumberbatch and Rebecca Hall.
You're such a paragon of honourable behaviour, Christopher. You're the cruelest man I know.
Bound by convention to duty and unhappiness.
I stand for monogamy. Monogamy and chastity.
Parade's End begins this Friday night at 9 on BBC Two.
This is BBC Radio 3. A very good evening to you. We're broadcasting between 90 and 93 FM on digital radio and in high definition online. 10 o'clock is the time now. Time for this week's Lebrecht interview. Here's Norman Lebrecht.
Andris Nelsons is the go-to conductor of the new generation. He's a regular with the Vienna Philharmonic, first call for vacant US orchestras, a fixture at Bayreuth and Luzern, and high in the list to succeed Antonio Pappano at Covent Garden, James Levine at the Met. He's mentioned everywhere. He's been music director of the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra since 2008, and before that, of Latvian National Opera. Remarkably, he's just 33 years old. Andris Nelsons is a very modern type of maestro. He was the first to take paternity leave in the middle of a busy concert season when his wife, Christina Opolis, gave birth last December. And when the baby developed complications, he broke off a prestigious orchestral tour to spend several months at her bedside. Born in Riga to a pair of professional musicians, he played trumpet and sang bass baritone before taking up the baton. He's the only private pupil of the shy and deeply contemplative Maris Janssens. His performances are marked by fluidity, passion, and a profound sense of tradition, most notably when he gave the 50th anniversary concert earlier this year of the Britain War Requiem in Coventry Cathedral. In the thick of a crowded summer, we struggled to meet up, finally getting together in Bayreuth between performances of Lohengrin. Andris Nelsons, looking out over the Wagner Hill. You must be the youngest man ever to conduct a complete ring in Riga. How old were you?
I was in the middle of 20s, I think mid-20s. So, but I think in the history there have been conductors conducting...
So young?
I'm not the youngest, I don't think I...
Right.
I mean, if you can call it conducting when you were 20, you know. That's...
I mean, what is it at that sort of age? Is it that you don't know fear? Or that you don't look down?
You know, when I was 18 years old, I got married first time. Now it's second time, which is my last time, I'm sure. But, and I thought, I know everything. I'm old enough to make decisions in my life, to be ready for family, and that I really am very confident. And in a way, that's also for young musicians. I think it's a certain sense of this feeling that you think, I am ready to express my feelings. It's not that I was ready and thought that I know many things, but I thought I know what I would like to express through music, and I think it is enough. And now I realize it's absolutely not enough. Now when I look back, I would never conduct pieces like what I did in my 20s, and I think I'm now a young conductor, and I think, you know, I don't want to sound, you know, it's a bit tough what I would say, but I don't think that conductor in 20s, you can really call that... You have a right to for interpretation. I mean, you have a right for interpretation, but it is like there is a certain age. In some countries, it's 18 years, in some countries, it's 21. When you call yourself grown up, and when you can start drink alcohol,
yeah,
officially. So, and I think the conductor, it's certainly not in 20s. I would say, and yesterday even listened to YouTube some interviews with Karajan and with all the other conductors. Where he was talking to Ozawa, asking him, how old are you? He told him, I'm 46. So he said, oh, you are so many things to learn still. And so I thought, actually, it means development of conductors all your life. So therefore, I think there is a fearless feeling when you are in your 20s. And this helps. I think for that age, it's important because then you have the feeling that you can do this piece, you can do Beethoven 9, you can do, you know, some Mahler symphonies, which actually is almost too early for calling you as an interpreter in that age. But I think if you do it in the right places, you need to start sometime, I think, and then to develop on the repertoire. And I don't think you can do a very deep Mahler's Second Symphony when you do it first time and then you're 65, if you haven't done it before. I mean, you can do it very deep, but you lack some even technical and professional skills which you need to experience through the age. So I think it's actually not bad if you start early. It's just you shouldn't call yourself a maestro. I would say generally getting older, if I may say, realizing that I don't know how people can at any age say, I know the right way of doing certain things. So I think with age, you get more and more divided in your thoughts about what is right and what is wrong. And actually, it doesn't get better, but it gets worse.
So now do you say to yourself, there are certain pieces I'm not going to do again until, or I'm not going to do at all until I'm at such an age, because I'm not ready for them?
Well, I think that the one thing is, I certainly would know there are certain orchestras which I wouldn't want to go to do certain pieces too early. Mm-hmm. Because, firstly, there are such a great maestros who have done it in the past in the age which is more suitable, maybe. Or also, you need to go through a certain tradition experience. Because there's some strong traditions how to play certain pieces, and the good traditions you have to know. And if you go in front of the, you know, Berlin Philharmonic or Vienna Philharmonic or, you know, Concertgebouw, and you do Mahler symphony which you have never done before, or you know, I think this is a not so clever move. But from the other hand, when you look to the history, you know, that each of these great conductors in the past, they have started early. So. But I think the thing is, they didn't start with the top orchestras immediately. So they went through the certain period of learning and of going through the repertoire and the experience.
In small towns and out of the way places.
And I think that's very. It's very tempting nowadays that you can sometimes such an offer to do things which you always wanted to do, but you have to judge. You have to have a very strong judgment of yourself, and that's. That's, I think, a difficulty.
So you were married and conducting opera before you were old enough to vote. Where did this confidence come from? This feeling in your late teens, I'm ready, I can do anything. Was that your parents? Was that society?
Yeah, I think it's a certain, I think, influence of the times where we're living. I think it was the Soviet Union still until I was 12. From one hand, you were kind of, you couldn't express what you really were feeling in these years. So you have to keep many things inside you. So you were not allowed to go almost into the church. So you could be very secretly to go to church, or you couldn't talk about the history openly. You couldn't discuss it even with your parents because it was forbidden. If somebody would find it out, it would be dangerous. And I think all of this energy which was hiding inside, came out in these years of, you know, gaining independence of the country, which was...
End of communism. Independent Latvia.
Independent Latvia, yes. And then influence of Western world opening the doors for such a huge amplitude.
Do you remember the night that communism ended, that Latvia became independent?
I remember, yes. I was not scared then. Now I would be... I don't know, I would probably go with my family to even to Africa or somewhere just to hide. But then I was very brave, you know, there was tanks in the city, and my stepfather, he went, you know, there were people just guarding near the television house, near the radio house, just to protect from the tanks, you know, as with the life, as it happened in these years. But I was not afraid. It was a very patriotic and very optimistic time in a certain sense. And I think all this energy came out, and this was a time when I started to play trumpet, when I started to sing, and I was encouraged to practice a lot in order to succeed something in life. And that was this extreme energy, an extreme patriotic feeling. And I was playing trumpet 6 hours a day, you know, at school from 8 to 2, and then from 2 to 7 o'clock every day, practicing. And I thought I would need to become a good trumpet player, or I could go out to other countries and I could express myself. And this was, I think, a very big push from this historical political situation which is around, I think, as well.
It's quite an unusual response, Andres, because, you know, if you're 12 or 14 and suddenly freedom comes, then you want to grab freedom with everything. What you're describing is you are grabbing discipline, you're grabbing hard work, you're playing the trumpet 6 hours a day, you're investing in your future rather than seizing the moment.
That's right, yes. I don't know why it happened. I think this is, it, in a way, a certain illusion about great life. Not life, great life in the sense of the comfort and money, but in a artistically and humanly fulfilled life. And I always thought, maybe because of my parents and education, that you need to deserve things. You need to
earn them.
Work hard to earn them. Mm-hmm. And now, with this independence coming, you saw the light at the end of the tunnel. So you thought, it is possible. So because in the Soviet time, you thought, well, I can do anything, but nobody, I would even not be able to go to another country because it's just, you know, it's just closed. And But now you thought, you know, the whole world is open, and if you earn something, you can really experience a different kind of life. And I don't know, it gave you a lot of discipline. I must say, that's probably why there's a lot of in my generation, and maybe a little older, musicians coming from this part of the world. I think this is very much for this reason. And also, of course, because of the education and the musical education and the, you know, tradition of very good singing tradition and so on. But it's also a political situation.
Is this something that came from inside, or that someone said to you that if you work hard enough, you will deserve freedom?
No, I think this. I was educated
in that way.
In that way. So,
tell me about your parents. Your father was principal cello in the National Orchestra.
Yeah, my father was principal cello in the National Symphony Orchestra. Although my stepfather, he was the one who grew me up,
yeah,
and he introduced me to music. And of course, my mother, she's a professor in music academy, and so she was a founder of first early music group in Latvia. It was the first ensemble who was singing Renaissance and Baroque music and English madrigals in Italian. And
that's really radical under communism.
It is very radical, yes.
And was she taking a risk?
I think she was taking certain risk, of course, because everybody always thought, you know, in that time, and if you do something what Western Europe does, it is not good and it's against the party.
She was a rebel.
Yeah.
And she sang English madrigals to you.
Yeah.
What did she sing?
Well, I remember, you know, the Silver Swan, mostly English madrigals. Lasciatemi morire with Monteverdi, then Gesualdo and all these great composers, William Byrd and Tallis Mass. And it was my first musical experience. And of course, from the other hand, my stepfather, he introduced me to Wagner. I was 5 years old when he took me to the first opera. It was Tannhäuser in Riga. But even then, before I went to the opera, he put me LPs, and we were listening to Tannhäuser, and he was analyzing and told what is this about, and what is the story, and what is the feeling. And I knew the music before I was actually going to listen to the opera. So
you were 5 years old.
I was 5 years old.
And you knew all the themes of Tannhäuser,
yes,
before
you... He told this is the leitmotiv of this and that. And so this is the influence, of course, certainly of my parents as well, as why I'm a musician, really, and that's... I still remember this time listening to Tannhäuser. We just switched off the lights so we to have the feeling of being in the audience, in the room, in the house. And then we listened to the music, and then I just was sitting, and I still remember it was so great feeling. And I still have this... And you probably, I think it's like when you smell the perfume, it always associates with certain person or certain time or certain place. When you smell all this perfume, I remember this place. And I have this association with Wagner, and it's such a warm and such a mystic feeling which I associate. I still remember this feeling exactly what I was when I was five, when I conduct Wagner now. So I think this association which goes through your life with this experience, it comes from my parents and from my childhood.
And when you
go to see the performance for the first time and you're 5 years old and you're dressed up in your best clothes and you're going with your parents to the opera house, what was your first impression of the opera house and of the performance of the stage?
Two things I remember very clearly. One was this nervousness which started when the lights went down.
Mm-hmm.
And this expectation of something special. And it's such a nervousness. My heart was beating very fast. And then the other feeling is that that's where my conducting dream came from. Because when the conductor came on the podium, I was very nervous about him. I thought, oh my God, this guy, he is doing something with his hands and everybody is playing. And if he does something wrong, it can stop and he can destroy everything. And I thought, it's such a responsibility. And that's why I thought, I would love to be involved in this, with music in this way. So actually you can build with your hands and be responsible of such a thing. And then the other thing I remember, I was crying after the opera. I was really crying when Tannhäuser died. And when there came this, the ladies' choir at the end, and Gwent is so touching, and I was crying.
It's quite an unusual combination of emotions that you're describing. You're feeling a strong identity with the conductor and a terrible anxiety that he's going to make a mistake and bring everything crashing down and it will be the end of the world. And that you would like to be him, you would like to take over. So in a sense, you're wishing for his success and you're wishing for his death.
Well,
is that what you feel now when you stand in the podium?
You know, I think there is a certain sense, it's very difficult to describe, but there's a certain sense of masochism involved, you know. It's not only in joy, which is, of course, the great joy, to conduct and to feel this joy of conducting, but this is also this joy of being nervous, you know, of having this fear or anxiety, which gives you this feeling that actually something can go wrong, I mean, very easily.
The fear that you're describing is actually part of the pleasure.
I think it's part of the pleasure, part of the satisfaction of conducting, because that you hear your heart beating and sweating because of the anxiety and it's like expectation of something. When you the music, they're playing Lohengrin, for example, in second act, there is one place after duet of Elsa and Ortrud, where the orchestra plays a very beautiful solo line, and I'm waiting for this moment for the first act, and I'm, my heart is starting to beat when it comes, and I feel, you know, this kind of feeling of masochism, and you think it also can go wrong. It's a wrong feeling to be a conductor, maybe in this way, to think like that, but I don't have this confidence of, some people say, I have rehearsed, I'm very confident, everything will be fine, and I will do a good concert, or you know, I'm a boss, or I never have this kind of feeling when I'm conducting, never have feeling of being a boss of a situation, because it's at the end, you are only conducting, you are only in front of these people, just, there's a lot of faith involved, that you trust them, that actually they will play, and they will sing, or they will do everything in the right way, and I'm actually, there's a lot of anxiety about how it will going to happen. You never know how the concert or performance will go. There's always this anxiety, and I think this would give you the pleasure as well. I mean, of course, maybe it's a confession, which I say it doesn't sound very very typical conductor like. You need to be confident. Of course, there's a confidence, but you project
a confidence to the musicians, to the singers. They have to believe you're going to lead them to the right place.
Yeah, no, I think this is because there's so much psychology, of course, involved, and that's. But it's never the feeling that, for example, of confidence or guarantee something. It's just a, you can guarantee that you do everything possible. But I think it's a more feeling of creating at the moment. So not that you have rehearsed it before and now you know what you're going to get, but you have rehearsed. But actually now you are creating during the concert and you don't know how it's going to be. So it's. From that sense, I think, for me, very close, you know, like Kleiber, for example, somebody like, of course, absolutely unconfident people who, genius.
Yes.
But I think probably it's also this kind of masochistic feeling, what you have towards yourself. It's a self-criticism, but which gives a pleasure and actually which pushes you to make a better result. So there is no routine involved. And I don't know, it's a strange combination, I personally think. I mean, it's a big confession, but it's strangely, when I conduct, then I don't have this doubt. During the conducting, I don't know where the power comes, where the confidence comes from, but that's why I decided to conduct, because during conducting, I see that I overcome my fear of being, you know, shy or being judged. It disappears when I'm on the podium. Before, you think, how I will go, what I will do there. But then you go there, you just, something happens. And that's why, that was the first time I experienced it. Conducting when I was 17, I conducted the high school orchestra in the rehearsal. And I felt so great. The best place in the world was that moment for me. I felt myself, that I can be so open, and I'm not shy anymore. I always, you know, was, and that's why I decided to become conductor, because I thought that's the best place for me. When I was playing trumpet, I thought always nervous and never satisfied.
And then while you were playing trumpet, you were also singing and taking singing lessons.
Yeah.
And you came to England, you did masterclasses with Evelyn Tubb, Emma Kirkby.
Yeah.
Were you thinking of being a professional singer, a bass baritone?
Yes, I was thinking very confidently. Of course, I was singing a lot of Baroque and Renaissance music at first. And I went to the master classes here, and it was in Dartington master course, I remember. It was a really wonderful time. And then I thought I was doing more Bach and some classical repertoire, some Rossini. And then I really wanted to become a bass baritone. But I thought if I was a tenor, I probably would have been a singer. Because I thought, you know, in that age, when I was 18, 17, I thought, you know, I wouldn't like to be Basilio or Bartolo. I want to be Almaviva, or I want to be Alfredo or Rudolfo. You know, if I can't be, then I. Now I think actually singing Scarpia, for example, I think it's more interesting than Cavaradossi or. But I think I was keeping trumpet, singing, and started to study conducting. And I want. And at one moment I did the whole three together, and I thought I would continue it. Then I realized, of course, you can't. It's not enough time.
You can only do one.
You can only do one, you know. And then it came to conducting. And actually, I'm very happy. And I realized how lucky I was that I could play in the orchestra myself and be involved in singing, to try to understand the breathing of the body, you know, and how much it helps for music now, for opera or symphony. I value it so much now, because it's. It helps me so much to
talk to the singers and to help and them.
And to kind of realize that everything is, again, the rhythm, the feeling of rhythm and being precise, it's a very relative term, you know, to me. I think it's, for me, I think it's so much to do with heartbeat. And one moment it's 60, and in one moment 62 beats a second, and then 68. And the composers never... Except some people like Mahler, for example, who was a conductor himself. I think that's why he did in each bar almost something, Nicht Eilen, Nicht Schleppen, because he knew that you would like to, and he leads you with his heartbeat. But it doesn't mean that the symphony of Brahms Brahms was meaning it exactly with no sense of breathing. I might be wrong again, but it helped to understand that everything is more relative than that. You can't put everything on the paper, which is actually inside the music.
So interpretation begins with your own bodily sensations.
I think so. It's very strongly that if you feel uncomfortable, you lack the air when you listen to music, or...
You're holding your stomach as you say this. You're talking as a singer.
Yeah. Yes, I think so. Then I think... Obviously, it's a sign that something is wrong to me. I don't know. The other thing is, of course, sometimes music especially wants to make you sick, you know, in some moments when you take this tempo a little slower than the heart does.
Yep.
And then you feel that you will just collapse, because it makes you sick, and and you can consciously make this sense for audience. But I think it all comes from the... body pulsation and the biological watch or something, I don't know.
The trumpet, which is also about breathing, gave you your first break. Maris Janssens came to Riga with the Oslo Philharmonic, was performing Berlioz Symphony Fantastique, and his first trumpet fell sick. And you were how old?
I think I was about 23. Yes, I was about 22, 23.
Right. And you just came out from the wings and...
Yes, I was in the audience, and of course I I was sitting in the audience already, and then I told, well, the manager came to me and he heard I played trumpet. Can I do the Symphony Fantastique in the next half, because I have four trumpets? So I ran to get my trumpet and did the symphony with Maurice, and it was another great push for me to realize that I really want to become a conductor somehow. Seeing him, of course, and I was already then studying conducting. And
you're getting a lot of special eye contact with him in the performance because you haven't rehearsed.
Yes, of course, special eye contact. And I realized that, I mean, his way, of course, it's so much encouraging. Of course, it's clear technically, but it's so much inspiring that I thought that's how the conductor should be. And that's when I realized that I want to be, to lead the orchestra the same direction as he has showed me.
And then you just went up to him afterwards and said, please, can I study with you?
He asked for me to come to say thanks, and he asked me, how much do you want to be paid? And I told, I don't want to be paid, but can I go to see you in Oslo, you know? And I went to Oslo to see him, and then that's how we started. I showed my videos. I've been conducting in the youth orchestra, and that's how we started. He told if he would have an assistant position, he would take me as assistant, that he didn't have, I was so lucky that day. I remember I was calling home. You know, Maurice just told that he, you know, I was remember this, and of course then I started to follow him, and then I was 22. I remember, yeah, 22 then. And it all started at Oslo. And it's interesting that I conducted Oslo Philharmonic, also Symphony Fantastique, many years later. And it was a great, interesting memory because of seeing the same musicians I was playing with and to do the same symphony. And the same trumpet player colleagues which were playing in the orchestra.
He has fantastic technical knowledge,
yeah,
of the orchestra. Did he also give you a philosophy of conducting?
I think so. I think that's actually probably the most important thing, I would say. It's a philosophy and the meaning of conducting, which is, I think, in my opinion, that the reason why I really conduct it is, this is this encouragement, to encourage, to give the atmosphere and to open your fantasy to music and to be as a soul of the piece, you know, in a certain sense as a soul. You almost have a reincarnation, that the moment you conduct the Brahms or Mahler or somebody comes, the spirit comes into you, or in a certain sense, and then you just reincarnate, and then at that moment
you become the composer,
and
you become the piece.
Become the piece, and I think that's the soul of the piece, and that's the meaning of conductor, and also came from Maurice, because his way of inspiring musicians with his face, with his hands, with his energy, it's just so, so great. I think in a way he continues this kind of Kleiber direction of fantasy world of music.
But it's also, it's...
And combines, of course, his own influence of Karajan Mravinsky and his own great talents. So it's, but this kind of psychological involvement as a conductor, so how to work with musicians, it's a lot of psychological invitation to them, so they feel that they want to do it for you. It's not that you force, because they need to know why they need to do this or this tempo, because you explain the character or the atmosphere, and also that you have to be always very prepared, that we always and rehearsals, that's an extremely important thing, because rehearsal process is the most important, I think, for conductor during the making chemistry with the orchestra and creating the family together. It's, if it doesn't happen in rehearsal, it's very difficult, I think, to create in the concert, because you don't have a trust from each other, and there is a certain reservation, and you can never flow into the same flow, you know. I think if you get this feeling in the rehearsals, then the concerts can be just, you know, explosion, and that's why it's important, he always told, and his way of rehearsing is really very extraordinary, so very prepared and always. So I think there's so many things I learned from him, you know, and in the meantime, of course, there are things if you spend a lot of time with somebody, you, of course, subconsciously take something, and you can't avoid that, but you can never copy. It doesn't work. It's just, you know.
The same year that you stand in as trumpet in the Oslo Philharmonic, they ask you to become principal conductor of the National Opera.
in Latvia. What was your response? You're 23 years old.
I was 23 years old, yes. And it's really strange because that was the orchestra I was playing myself. I was playing the opera orchestra in Riga myself since 17. And I did some performances when I was 21, you know, some Traviata, some Malo Maschera, and I was playing in the orchestra and conducted, you know, once in 3 months a performance and studied parallelly. I couldn't say no somehow because I always wanted to, of course, wanted to conduct, and I was studying, and of course I took the chance, and I always thought that it's a really dangerous if you come from the same orchestra. It's really almost impossible if you play in the same orchestra as you then conduct. It's very difficult for you to get the, not the authority, but just to you know, people to look at you as somebody who can actually conduct. And but I had a great support from the orchestra, and that's maybe why, the reason why I continued, and when I realized that I want to continue and I can try to do this job. And that's why I realized actually it's, so being conducted, it is a teamwork with the orchestra. It is a, of course, it is a leadership in a certain sense, of course, and it is a confidence you have to give and the ideas, but it is like in a boat, a captain in a boat, you know, actually if there is a storm, there is your team which helps you. Actually, you can't do anything yourself, really. It's all together. And but and I remember I asked Maris, because I was actually offered the position of principal conductor in the symphony orchestra as well as the opera in Riga both. And I wanted to take both at 23. And then I asked Maris, what should I do, like symphony orchestra or opera? And I remember him telling that if you want to conduct opera in your life later, then it's better to start with the opera, because later you wouldn't have time, you know, you wouldn't have, you just, one thing, your symphony will grow up, and then the other thing, you have no time. And then, and I'm very happy, because he told you have to make decision with yourself, but I remember that, and actually I took the opera, and I now I am very thankful, because without that move, I wouldn't be able to conduct in Bayreuth, or in the Metropolitan, or anywhere, really. You know, now I think I would love to do opera in my life, maybe as a music director, but maybe when I'm 60 years, I was thinking, like I think that later, I'm thinking, no, you know, it's such an institution that, you know, but that was something which, I think, which for every young person, there's a driving force to succeed something when you have this fearless feeling. It doesn't mean that, in this age, you really can call yourself a, for right to be interpreting things. But I think if somebody would ask me, I would still say that you have to start to conduct early in order to grow till a certain age.
Hmm. It's a house with a big Wagner tradition, Riga. Wagner was music director there, wrote Flying Dutchman while he was there. You were conscious of that, that you were...
Yes.
That, yeah.
You
were stepping into Wagner's place.
Yeah. No, I was conscious, of course, of that. And of course, I always had a great passion for Wagner. And he was very young when he was in Riga.
Yeah, late 20s.
Late 20s. So I thought, you know, I was more brave when I was, you know, I was really more brave. Now I realize it's not enough to know what you want. It's absolutely not enough. It's important. Without that, you actually can't even start conducting. But this is just the one. It's the first point. It's just, you know what you want and what you want to succeed from music and what you want to express. This is first thing when you actually can start. But then you need how to make it work and how to make them believe in you and how to succeed in rehearsals, that actually they understand what you want, and then they want to know why do you want like this, you know, and I have to explain why, you know, in order to them to be on your side.
The conductor at Bayreuth is invisible. You are underneath the cowl with the orchestra. Nobody sees you at all. So in a sense, you can just focus on the music, just on the extraordinary quality of sound that you get in that house, and forget about the visual altogether.
I think for a conductor who wants to show himself and whose conducting part is also his visual sympathy or it doesn't work here. No, so basically your ego as a conductor is very much killed here in a bad sense. I think it's really healthy because you are in the pit, you are just separated together with the orchestra and you feel so united with the orchestra. I feel it's such a great team. Before, for example, the opera starts, you know, you have these lights the inspicient give you when you can start, and then you start, and an audience don't know when it starts, and it all starts from nowhere. And so the ego of conductor has been killed. So it's in order to present the music as a number one. And I think, to me, it's so sympathetic and so exciting that I try to put, you know, to put the composer as a on the podium. And this situation in Bayreuth really does it, you know. It certainly kills the ego of conductor, you know, because you the conductor is not seen, and then you just hear the music and you enjoy it, and you know, no distractions are possible besides the direction. You know? So, but musically, it's really, it's all secondary, you know. How do you look visually? How you shaved or perfumed? It's all secondary. Most important is the music, and that's how I think you can concentrate on that music. And
so, the first rule for conducting Wagner in Bayreuth: first kill the conductor.
Well, it is to put the conductor in the right.
In his place.
In his place.
In his place.
In his place.
Invisible.
Not more than
invisible.
Yeah, because you know it. Cause there's no cult of conductor. It's cult of Wagner, and that's why I feel here. When you go sometimes to other opera, you know, any place, you think, oh, I'm going to see this production because, you know, Kaufman or Gergiu or Trepko, whatever, is singing, and I want to see, oh, this is a Carmen, I'm going to see this because of this soloist. And actually you forget that there's a conductor, there's an orchestra, and, you know, it's secondary. But here you go because, I want to hear Wagner's Lohengrin, I want to hear Wagner's Parsifal. So this is the primary, it's Wagner, it's always, and you come to Bayreuth because of Wagner, not because of certain singer. I mean, mostly I think so. And that's really, I think this is a great thing because it's all about music and it's obsessed with that, but it's really, when you come to work here, it's because you love this music, and that's, I think you can feel it. And the orchestra, you know, it's such a family feeling. They're all smiling, they're all passionate about what they do, and you don't have to prove that this music is great. They just love it and it helps you to see it. I mean, it's really amazing, I feel in, you know, to be involved in this, for me, because of this Wagner experience in a five-year-old boy, it's just amazing. And now I'm so happy. I have new Parsifal in 16 in Bayreuth, which comes, and I, you know, and so I know maybe next 8 years will be in Bayreuth for me. So it's really,
you know, how your summers are going to be spent.
Yes, I think so. I know how my summers, yeah.
After people came to see your ring in Riga, you started getting invitations from different orchestras, and you were conducting Maris's orchestra in Munich, Bavarian Radio, when the manager in Birmingham, Stephen Maddock, came to hear you, and he asked you to come and conduct his orchestra. But it wasn't even a proper concert. It was an audition of a hall,
yeah,
that you came to do, the refurbished town hall. And it was out of that audition that the musicians started sending texts to Stephen saying, can we have this man as our next music director? What was your impression of those events?
Well, of course, I knew that the CBSO are looking for a new music director because of Sakari leaving, and it was quite urgent, not urgent, but, well, they were looking very intensively, and I knew that I would be a candidate. Of course, I knew that I've never been there before and they wouldn't know me, but so it was a big pressure from that sense. I knew, because if it goes wrong, certainly I would be out of the list.
What was the piece? Was the program?
The first piece we rehearsed was Don Juan,
mm-hmm,
and then Schatz. Yeah, and then was Dvorak 9. So these both pieces we rehearsed, and I felt this great chemistry with the orchestra, and I didn't know what they think. I was very scared, and I didn't know what to think. And then we had after this concert, which was a 2 days rehearsal, we had a recording with Bajo Skrida, the violinist, Tchaikovsky Violin Concerto. And that was in the Symphony Hall. And after that, Stephen came to me and asked, well, would I accept the position? And I was really, I was of course very surprised because of course I knew that the orchestra doesn't know me much, but this somehow happened very quickly. And I think sometimes when you meet a person, that's a love from the first sight, you know. Sometimes it can be a love which develops through many years of knowing each other and through the friendship, or, but it can be also that love from the first sight. And I think that's was probably this expression I could use with Birmingham. And I mean,
it was quite amazing to watch it happen, because often a new music director comes to a city and there's a lot of publicity, and sometimes you even see his picture on bus stops. Yeah. And in Birmingham, I was there at your first concert, people were saying, Nelson's, is he any relation to the Admiral?
Yes. I think this is, it is still to me like a miracle, because now it's 4 years we've been together in Birmingham with the orchestra, and this is the fifth season we will start, and I still feel like we are just beginning. So the same freshness, so there is no routine in our relationship, and I'm really surprised how it's possible, but it's really how it is. And I think it's a great support what the orchestra has for their conductor. It's always, you know, with Simon Rattle, they had such a, you know, great relationship through so many years, and they supported him, and this, the same happened with Zachary after Simon, and now I feel this support towards myself. I think it's a great characteristic of the orchestra that they choose their conductors. It was not a decision only of the management or the board, but it was a decision all everybody together, and that's really, I think, why it's really important, in my opinion. For me, it would be important with any orchestra I would take in future or theoretically. It's really important to have this making decision all as a team decision, and that's, I think, why it still works very well together. And I still think we have this journey which already 4 years, but it still is just starting.
Well, you've just decided this week to sign a new contract.
Yes, and of course.
You've got the whole world banging at your door, and you're saying, no, I'm staying in Birmingham.
So it's, well, you know, we have such a great relationship and great plans with concerts in Birmingham, with a lot of tours, you know, in such a great places in the world. I'm really privileged to have such an orchestra who want to work together, and they don't throw me out, and I'm really very happy about this. And I'm really happy that I can, you know, prolong the contract as a renewal by annual.
The rolling contract.
The rolling contract, starting from 14-15. So I will certainly stay for 14-15, and then I will see how life will develop our relationship and how long I can be there. I'm very happy about this. And
the orchestra is changing. There's a generational change.
Yes, it's also
many of the Rattle players are now going into retirement, and you're bringing in new players. The sound is changed since you've been there.
I never wanted to, I had never in my feeling intention to change the sound of orchestra to become it, you know, exactly like this.
No, but it's become orchestra in those 4 years.
But it's somehow, I feel, you know, when I conduct, I feel that we understand each other from the half word. So basically, and it's really difficult to describe exactly what it is. I think it is, I always have the feeling of the flexibility and sensitivity of music making. So we are very sensitive to rubato or to the pulse of music, the heartbeat of music. So we are, it's never exactly 88. The whole piece way through or 60 beat, you know, per second. There's some music where it has to be, but it is, I think, as from my singing tradition of music as a heartbeat, as a breathing. I think it's, and I feel that we breathe together. And of course, we have a lot of, you know, ideas about the sound, about the dynamic, about the range of dynamic from the great pianissimos to the, you know, very strong fortes and to.
And in Symphony Hall, you have better possibilities than anywhere in Britain.
Symphony Hall is absolutely, I think this is the best hall in Britain. I mean, if I may say that, I think it's, we are very, very privileged about that. And I think I want to explore these possibilities with the orchestra together let's see how far it can go.
Andres Nelsons, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you very much. A great pleasure.
Andres Nelsons talking to Norman Lebrecht, and the producer of the programme was Tony Cheevers. And don't forget that programme is available to listen to again on the Radio 3 website. You can also download the programme from there. Well, Norman is back next Monday evening at 10:30 when he'll be talking to the celebrated Italian conductor Riccardo Muti. And Andres Nelsons conducts tomorrow night's prom. He leads the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra in music by Glinka, Emily Howard and Shostakovich, his 7th symphony, the Leningrad. That's at 7:30, live here on BBC Radio 3 tomorrow night.
On Radio 3 from the BBC Proms, Valery Gergiev conducts Prokofiev's Cinderella. A rare opportunity to hear Prokofiev's fairy tale ballet score in its full glory, with a conductor steeped in the Russian ballet tradition. The London Symphony Orchestra and Valery Gergiev at the BBC Proms on BBC Radio 3, Wednesday night at 7:00.
Well, now it's 11:15, and next tonight it's time for the essay. The Interrail Pass, which originally permitted young people a month's travel by train across Europe for the sum of just £26.50, recently reached its 40th birthday. Well, to mark this occasion last year and to explore how much Europe and student travel have changed over the decades, five writers were each commissioned to write an Interrail postcard. And this is another chance to hear the first of those writers, Adam Thorpe.
In 1974, Interrail was so new that it wasn't yet a verb. I remember saying, "I'm doing Interrail," as Jim Morrison had done heroin, and it had a hyphen between inter and rail. The unpleasant idea of removing the hyphen, but still keeping the two R's, with the R of rail capitalised, had not yet come in. Is it a kind of single-word concrete poem, illustrating a particularly bad jolt on the train tracks at 2 a.m? My friend Chris and I were technically 17, but felt 13. This was our first proper trip abroad without parents. The Interrail card announced itself, under its funky, flared-looking logo in denim blue, as a facility for young persons. It cost £27.50, second class. For the average young person, this was a lot, and I must have helped towards it in some way. Odd jobs around the home? My home was, in fact, in Cameroon, West Central Africa, while my school was in Wiltshire. This resulted in a mildly schizoid existence, since in Africa we had no television, radio was only Radio Dweller or the World Service's inaudible whisper, and international phone calls had to be booked in advance. So parental knowledge of my Interrail trip was patchy. If I was mashed to mincemeat in a rail crash, or done away with by a local dominici in some lonely European spot, they might never know. I entertained thoughts like these, packing a shiny new rucksack in the school dorm. In went my Interrail card, passport, traveller's checks, no credit cards in that dim epoch, and an idiotic quantity of books, including Anna Karenina. Chris and I had the genuine John Lennon-type NHS specs and were bookish. I would never catch up with him, because he seemed already to have read everything, but I reckoned that hours on trains would give me ample opportunity. We weren't even sure how long we would be away. We had bought a 22-day card, but that, like our destinations, was open-ended. It certainly seemed rather a long time. I didn't have to book a flight to Douala, since my father worked for Pan Am, and I could hop on any of its aircraft free, as long as there was space. I already had the flying equivalent of an Interrail card and could have flown Pan Am to Honolulu. But Pan Am was the normal background hum to my life, its marketing ephemera providing much of my bedroom decoration. The topless Pan Am calendar for 1972 was my favourite. It was so banal, I never saw its potential. Instead, it was the Interrail card that seemed like the incredible passport to freedom. You arrived somewhere, you got bored, you entered the name of your destination on the card, you flashed it, and you are off. Not quite to anywhere, though. There was a simple map on the card showing the main rail routes extending spider-like over Europe. This was, of course, a severely curtailed Europe. Apart from a route through East Germany to Berlin, most of the East was forbidden territory. I pictured the trains hitting the Iron Curtain with a bang. We set off for Europe with a list of youth hostels and, thanks to Dr. Carter, our inspiring history teacher, a precocious interest in medieval architecture and Italian art. But the joy of the Interrail Pass was that you could use the trains as overnight hostels. Maybe not every night, but for motionless nights we had a YHA card, and Italy at the time was dirt cheap. We planned to live on pasta and Chianti. This was to be an Italian art holiday, in fact. At the back of my mind, I can't speak for Chris here, was the idea that we would meet girls, girls of a nut-brown loveliness. Our first stop, we decided, would be Venice. We wrote Venezia in the box and set off from Paris on a night train that would take us through the Simplon Pass, our very first leg. We found an empty compartment and stretched out on the brown seats. The train wheezed and juddered into life. We were off. The anxiety of preparation transformed into the exhilaration of achievement. The sway of the train, France passing the carriage window looking incredibly France-like, meant we were truly embarked. The adventure begun. To seal my happiness, I had bought a packet of gitane on the train, the sweet-scented type since banned by the EU, to Philip Morris's delight. Up to then, I had only, occasionally, smoked number 10s. My first drag blistered my throat and turned me yellow, to Chris's amusement. I had unwittingly bought an unfiltered pack, the tobacco leafing off on my tongue. Our minimal spending power meant that I couldn't buy another, but I gingerly adapted. Nowhere on the card did it say how overnight trains smell. A mixture of diesel smoke and a subtle, indefinable sourness that turned out to be mostly yourself. Neither did it mention the Neronian ticket inspectors who would wake you up from deep sleep by banging their metal punches on the door, then scowled and sighed as you fumbled for the card, which they stamped as if they were stamping on a hippie. In the middle of the night, some Italian men entered and we had to relinquish our beds, resigning ourselves to nodding off in an upright position, the clear, cold smell of the Alps, full of grass, flowing through the window into the carriage's fog. As dawn broke, we woke to find ourselves on our own again, the Italian countryside trundling past, looking incredibly like Italy. This is magic, I thought, sleep deprivation and the sense of freedom sending me into a happy trance. I heard a strange gurgling noise, looked up, saw Chris's face opposite. It was agonised. He had slept with his wallet next to him, containing Interrail pass, traveller's checks, cash, passport. It was no longer there. It had been stolen. We decided to get off at the next stop, in case the thieves did the same. We pulled into a station called, judging by the signs, Ushita. We were the first out. Ushita seemed popular as a crowd disgorged itself and we took it in turns to run up and down the platform. The Italian men all looked the same. Suddenly, a man with ginger hair approached us waving Chris's wallet, minus only cash, £5, equivalent to 5 hostel nights. He had found it in the train's toilet bowl. He was Scottish. Alighting at the same station, called in fact Mestre, Ushita means exit in Italian, he'd heard us bewailing our loss, checked Chris's photo, and found himself sporting enormous feathery wings. Chastened, we hugged our valuables close and went on to Venice. There is no better way of arriving in Venice than by rail, preferably at dawn. You come out of the station and almost fall into the Grand Canal. I repeated the experience via an overnight train 2 years ago and was moved to tears. At 17, bowed under a rucksack, I was more concerned with finding the hostel, but the unreality of Venice in the bright morning sunshine was overwhelming. We knew Italy was cheap, so we walked to the Piazza San Marco and ordered a beer. The bill came, and it felt like half our budget. We walked over humpback bridges in a smell of bilge, laundry flapping from every window, and reached the youth hostel, which looked out on the lagoon. We were desperate to shed our rucksacks, but the queue of international youth, mostly slumped against the wall, did not look promising. After a long wait, during which the sun sparkling off the water was the only sign of activity, we asked a fellow hopeful whether he reckoned there'd be enough beds for everyone. "No," he said. Stupidly, there are so many opportunities to be stupid, travelling as a teenager. We believed him. So what to do? Hotels were beyond our price range, and in those days sleeping rough in a foreign country attracted policemen, and we knew that the police, especially in Italy, had real paid-up fascists in their ranks, for whom 1968 still had to be avenged. Both Chris and I had long hair. The wonder of the Interrail Pass began to show its habit-forming side. We either paid a lot to sleep somewhere that wasn't moving, or we flashed our card and hopped back on another train, travelling a sufficient distance to give us a whole night. So, amazing as this sounds, we decided to return to Paris. We staggered onto solid land in Paris, found an accommodation bureau in the Gare de Lyon, and collapsed in a seedy but gloriously unmoving dormitory. Paris was nice, but expensive, so we looked at the map and fancied Strasbourg. We wanted quiet forests to picnic in, and I knew Alsace had a lot of those. Alsace was cool and drizzly. We found an all-wooden hostel in a place called Saint-Dié, the only other person being a chatty German boy, not much older than us, fresh from his military service. How different others' lives are from ours, we considered, as we ate our cheese in the scent of the pines. We wanted heat again, so we waved our wand and were sped to Florence. We arrived, paid our £1 for the hostel, found a very cheap trattoria just off the Piazza della Signoria, drank a lot of Chianti. I sketched a satyr on the piazza's fountain and then lay back on the stone lip, staring up at the stars as they emerged from a deep, inky sky. That afternoon, I'd sat as close as I dared to a long-haired girl of exceptional beauty who was strumming her guitar on the cathedral steps and singing Knockin' on Heaven's Door, which was pretty new at the time. Now someone else was playing Cat Stevens. The fountain splashed, the stars twinkled, the world swayed, the guitar strummed, and I was completely happy. It was all going to be like this, I thought, from now on. We're right on the threshold. It wasn't just that I was naive. It was that a lot of the 1970s had still to run. Our money dwindled to nothing, and we had to cut our trip short by a few days. I went to the Pan Am office in Paris and asked them to send a telex to my father in Douala, saying I'd be back early. We'd set out thinking our card was a magic wand that whisked you to the other side of Western Europe. Except, of course, trains were generally not on time, and the waving of the wand was followed by another W word, waiting. All Interrail noughts, if that's what they're called these days, have spent a lot of time waiting, generally in a state of extreme somnolence, resulting from very poor nights in moving trains. Strong coffee and strong cigarettes were, back in the 1970s, the best antidote to a permanent state of sleepiness. You'd arrive at dawn somewhere vast and busy, head straight for a cafe, then armed with caffeine and nicotine, walk across the loud, frantic vastness under a large rucksack, getting lost on the way, and eventually make it to the hostel where, if there were beds, you collapsed, slept through the best part of the day, emerged to find the museums either closed or, if not free to students, too expensive, found a cheap source of protein somewhere, sandwiches, chips, pasta, then decided this wasn't your scene and waved your wand again. Somewhere else was bound to be better. On one of these treks, across Tours, I think it was, we met two Americans who said, "The hotel's a couple of blocks away." This literally meant nothing to us, and anyway, they were wrong. It was at least 10 blocks. Youth hostels are always the furthest point from wherever you start out. It's a rule. Fatigue sometimes took its toll. We had a fierce argument about how to cut watermelon, and I got in a huff during a riverside picnic in Amboise after Chris interrupted my monologue on the meaning of the universe by telling me that Gladstone used to chew each mouthful 20 times. And we never managed more than a few paragraphs of our itinerant library. All that we had succeeded in taking in was the signs in the trains. Ne pas se pencher au dehors. Nicht hinaus lehnen. E pericoloso spargersi. It is dangerous to lean out. But we did lean out, albeit cautiously, to feel the wind in our hair, the fresh rush of air, and still survived, and were left, curiously, wanting much more of the same.
The writer Adam Thorpe with his memory of interrailing in the 1970s. Tomorrow's Interrail postcard comes from the Sri Lankan-born writer Ramatian. The producer is B.T. Rubens.
BBC Radio 3 at the Edinburgh International Festival. Each weekday morning at 11 o'clock, we go live to Edinburgh to hear from a stellar lineup of musicians, including Rebecca Evans, John Williams and John Etheridge, Clare Williams, and the Australian Chamber Orchestra. Join us weekday mornings on BBC Radio 3 from 11 o'clock.
This is BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM on digital radio and online. It's now time for Jazz on 3 with Jez Nelson, who all this week is giving you a second chance to hear some of the best gigs and sessions they've recorded.
Hello. Trip-hop, glam rock, Scottish folk and a healthy dose of the jazz avant-garde. Just some of the sounds feeding into two of the most exciting British big bands of the moment, Beats and Pieces and Sid Peacock's Surge. That's the big band Surge, led by Northern Irish composer Sid Peacock, and they made their radio debut on Jazz on 3 last year. We'll be playing their session again for you later on in the programme. And also, flying the flag for the ongoing UK big band tradition, our Manchester-based ensemble Beats and Pieces, who performed in front of a home crowd at the Royal Northern College of Music earlier this year. They brought the house down with their brand of high-energy, groove-based music. Now, they're a fresh-faced lot just out of college, and they have a fresh sound to match. They take their inspiration from the likes of Radiohead and David Bowie, as well as the progressive large ensemble writing of Colin Townes. There was so much great music that we couldn't fit it all in the first time round, so that almost all of the set coming up is being broadcast for the first time. So here they are at the RNCM in Manchester, as I say, playing to their home crowd. This is the Beats and Pieces Big Band.
Yeah!